If it may please this honorable court, my name is Anthony Griffin. I'm a lawyer out of Galveston, Texas, and I have the pleasure of appearing before you representing James Blackstock, who at one point in time sat on the county court bench in Brazoria County as a judge. This case was tried over a week period of time. Jury rendered a verdict on July 15, 2011, and they entered findings on a number of different issues. One, that Mr. Blackstock had created a hostile work environment. Two, that he violated the bodily integrity of each plaintiff. Three, that there was intentional infliction of emotional distress, and compensatory damages was entered for Kalina, K-A-L-I-N-A, for $50,000, Strong for $100,000, Rebecca Sermons for $50,000. And then there was a finding of reckless conduct and then punitive damages for each plaintiff for $1 million. We're before this court complaining in a sense that, and we attack the notion that under this circuit you can bring a 1983 action and couple it with a sexual harassment claim and get liability against someone who's not the employer. I think the Second Circuit and the Fifth Circuit take the position that under 1983 claim, your rights and remedies are tied to the claim in which you bring. In reference in the plaintiff's original complaint under jurisdiction and venue, it says this court's jurisdiction over the subject matter of this action, this is under appellant's record excerpt, and they cite 1331. They cite, including but not limited to Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as amended and under Section 1983. We went to trial with that, and then it says some pending jurisdiction cases, laws under state law. We went to trial under the notion that, and we filed a 12B6 under the notion that you have pled Title VII as your vehicle under 1983 by which to bring this claim. Nothing in this pleading mentioned the word bodily integrity. Nothing in this pleading mentioned the 14th Amendment. And I've searched this pleading up and down, and I can find no such language. In addition, in the complaint, when one looks at the complaint on page, on the first page of the complaint, it lists Kalina, Strong, and Sermons as plaintiffs, and it says the defendants of Brazoria County, Texas, Brazoria County Juvenile Probation Board, and James Blackstock. And throughout the pleadings, it makes reference to defendants. And in regards to Blackstock, it says in the pleadings, we're not seeking to hold Blackstock liable individually. But that's what they, in fact, did. Because during the course of the trial, and I'll reference the pleadings where that occurs, it's on page 5. Starting on page 5, to when each subjected to gender-based discrimination via a hostile work environment and suffers severe emotional distress and lost wages as a result of the harassment, Blackstock is not herein being sued under Title VII in his individual capacity. But when we went to trial and throughout the trial, when they rested their case, I asked the court for an instructive verdict because they had failed to prove the case. And as I understand Fifth Circuit law in the years of my being practicing law, that you can't bootstrap a 1983 cause of action and get greater remedies by filing it as a 1983 cause of action. This circuit has repeatedly said so, whether you filed a police misconduct case, whether you filed any type of case and used 1983 as a vehicle, you cannot get greater remedies. But what in fact occurred is that all of a sudden in this pleading before this court and in the argument before the district court, they said, well, we're not really suing him under Title VII, even though the language in the pleading says Title VII. And they take a position all of a sudden that what we're really suing him under this amorphous that sexual harassment, and they cite these Second Circuit cases, and they use the Second Circuit, and they try to bootstrap some New York cases and say that we can use sexual harassment as an independent vehicle under 1983, and that's simply not the law. And it's inconsistent with their pleadings.
They can sue him under Section 1983 for, let's say he'd raped them. He can be sued.
Absolutely. But on the basis of the pleadings before this court And what we're apprised of, it says Title VII as the vehicle by which he's being sued. And we defended it on that basis and brought to the trial court's attention that he is not an employer. Former Judge Blackstock, during the course of the trial, said, I use piss poor judgment. Absolutely. I don't think that's the issue. And I think the jury is free to believe, and I think that's what the, you know, when one comes before this court, the jury is free reasonably to believe that some conduct took place that was probably impermissible. Judge Blackstock stepped off the bench and gave his bench up. He pled guilty to a misdemeanor offense and gave his bench up and then was subject to civil lawsuits. And his wrong words was, I use piss poor judgment. But he's still entitled to that on the notice provisions, when these pleadings are put before that jury, then we can rely on the established law at the time. And I don't think this court and this circuit should change its rule of law that I've operated under for a number of years, that if I brought a 1983 cause of action as a plaintiff, then my rights come from that underlying statute in which I brought that claim. And what the district court did is the district court bootstrapped and said, well, we're going to submit a charge for bodily integrity, and I objected and said, well, there's nothing in these pleadings mentioning bodily integrity, Your Honor. And I'm entitled to some notice, and we've proceeded on trial on the basis of this Title VII claim.
Was the bodily integrity mentioned at all in the pretrial order?
My memory tells me no, Your Honor, and I'm going off my memory. I don't remember whether it was or not, but my memory tells me it was not. My memory tells me that the bodily integrity issue came up when there was an attempt to formulate the charge. And at the charge conference, when the charge was initially submitted by the plaintiff's lawyers, when the court worked the charge, it ultimately was added as a charge, and that's when I objected and said there's nothing in this charge to support that. We also assert
The complaint alleges this contributed to plaintiffs being sexually harassed by Blackstock. Accordingly, each defendant, he's one of them, is liable to the plaintiffs whether it or he is proven to be an employer or not. And then the pretrial order says plaintiffs were subject to sexual harassment and related sexually inappropriate conduct of a verbal and physical nature by Blackstock. So that's what the issue was.
But, Your Honor, even if that's so, one has to ask the question, where does the sexual harassment emanate from under law? Under their pleadings, it emanates from Title VII. And if you're going to, I won't disagree that sexual harassment, sexual assault is impermissible conduct, whether Blackstock is an employer or not. But if you're going to assert liability against me, then you must assert where that 1983 cause of action, what is being a vehicle for. Clearly, on the face of their pleadings, the vehicle by which they drive this case is Title VII, and when they realize they were in trouble, they start backing away from it. But it's a little too late to back away from it. In addition, in their pleadings, it says defendants or plaintiffs' joint employer. If that's not Title VII, then nothing is. He never gave them a paycheck. He didn't give them he didn't write their evaluations. He sat on a juvenile board, as all the other judges in Brazoria County, doing his judicial functions. He was a county employee, and they work for the juvenile board. Now, I know there's case law that says that the juvenile board is not part of Brazoria County, but that's not my issue here. My issue is that once you use 1983 as a vehicle, and that's stock Fifth Circuit law, then you have to look at what, in fact, is the vehicle by which you get there. And I don't think you can all of a sudden, by way of example, Your Honor, if I brought a claim and I have a citizen who was subjected to excessive force, and I make it clear that I'm complaining about not only the detention but the seizure, I'm not going to be able to boot my strep, unless someone sits silently and goes to sleep and doesn't object. I can't boot my strep and start talking about bodily integrity. The whole area of bodily integrity is something totally different. And that if I'm going to assert a seizure, I got to say a seizure. If I'm going to say that it was excessive force, then I must say so. And these pleadings, the way they're drafted, tell us that it's a Title VII claim that they're using as a vehicle. And there's one other thing on the pleadings I think that needs to be addressed. They assert that Blackstock is individually, paragraph 22, that he's individually liable to the plaintiffs for intentional infliction of emotional distress.
I'm trying to understand now where you're contending the error was made. Was the error made in allowing a Title VII claim to go forward, or was the error made in the giving of an instruction to the jury that they could make a finding as against this defendant on the bodily integrity violation?
Both. Once Blackstock is not an employer, instructive verdicts have been granted. As a matter of law, when we filed the JNOV, it should have been granted. He's not an employee. He's an individual person working for the county, and on the basis of their pleadings.
Well, wasn't that a legal question to be determined as a matter of law? In other words, did you need a jury trial to determine whether or not Judge Blackstock was a county, was the employer of these plaintiffs?
No, I don't think you need a jury trial for that. We filed a 12B6. There wasn't a motion for summary judgment filed. We filed at the end of the verdict. We asked the court for a directed verdict because he was not an employer. And then the argument.
Are you saying he should have granted a Rule 12B6 motion?
He should have granted
this or summary judgment motion to dismiss pretrial.
I apologize. I cut the court off.
That's all right.
He should have granted the motion when we asked for a directed verdict at the close of the evidence. He should have granted also the JNOV, the judgment notwithstanding the verdict.
So it was some factual determination about whether or not he was an employer of these plaintiffs. That was a factual dispute.
That's a factual issue. I don't think there's anything in the record that supports it. The trial judge, Judge Hart, did grant the JNOV on the intentional infliction of emotional distress. Supreme Court law in Texas provides that if, in fact, your sexual harassment claims comes out of the employment context, you can't bring an intentional infliction of emotional distress, and there were at least two Supreme Court cases on porn, and he did grant the JNOV on that. On the bodily integrity claim, there was no pleadings whatsoever, and I think that's our argument on that. There was no pleadings whatsoever to support it, and we did not lie in wait and sit and remain quiet on that issue.
And I guess, if you're going to get back to that, my question in that connection has to do with what I think is, and I'm getting this from someplace, I would imagine, like Judge King stated earlier, that there was at least a request for a jury instruction or a jury charge on the bodily integrity, which would have been submitted as part of a joint pretrial order, and that at that point you objected to it and the judge overruled the objection. Now, if all of that occurred, you were at least not without notice that they were making some claim about bodily integrity, and that would have put you on notice pre-trial. Now, whether or not all that occurred, I don't know. I'm getting this from some place, and it may not be accurate. So,
my memory tells me it didn't show up in the joint pretrial order, and what it showed up in, it showed up in the charge conference and got added in the charge conference.
Okay, so that was post-trial.
Yes, it was post-trial.
All right.
We also asserted that with regards to,
when I say post-trial, I guess, as I understand the way a trial develops, the evidence would have been closed by the time you get to a charge conference.
The plaintiff's evidence had closed, and the evidence is closed.
All right.
Okay. We also asserted limitations, and it was argued at the trial court we did not assert limitations. Under paragraph 2 of our complaint, we says, paragraph 7, defendants Blackstock submits that this court does not have jurisdiction nor venue over this matter, and the plaintiffs have failed to timely file suit under Title VII. And then when we go back to prayer for relief, we say under paragraph 15, paragraph 22, defendants assert limitations in regards to their paragraph 22. and then we asked it to be dismissed for want of jurisdiction. We did everything we could to say this case is not timely filed. The actions in this case took place as early as 2006 and 2007, and this lawsuit wasn't filed until 2010. So even under 1983, it wasn't waived. Even under 1983, time had barred, and Mr. Blackstock, even with his piss poor judgment, should not have been standing in the dock of the court, and this case should have been dismissed. I'll reserve the remaining portion of my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Martin Shellis from Houston, Texas. I represent the appellees in this case. I am mystified how Judge Blackstock, former Judge Blackstock, can suggest that he escapes liability for assaulting females because Title VII was available against the county. That's absolutely not the law, and I'm going to talk about that in a moment. It doesn't make sense. If that were true, if this court were to follow Mr. Griffin's suggestion, then people like Blackstock get off scot-free when they assault and fondle breasts. It isn't a case of piss-poor judgment. That's ridiculous. This is a case of assault. It's a case to which he pled criminally. So this confusion that Mr. Griffin spent the majority of his time speaking of, I think, stems from this. We sued the county, the probation board, and Judge Blackstock in his individual and official capacities. We settled with the county probation board and Judge Blackstock in his official capacity within a month or two of the suit being filed, leaving only claims against Judge Blackstock individually. In our complaint, we talk about the suit involving, at paragraph 10, page 3 of the complaint, sexual harassment and assault of the plaintiffs by Blackstock. We sued him for assault, which is actionable as a violation of bodily integrity. We sued for sexual harassment, which is actionable under Section 1983, typically in cases involving peace officers, but there are other cases involving other either elected officials or public officers.
So what you're telling me is that when you allege assault, that equals violation of bodily integrity. Is that
yes,
what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor, at least with respect to the complaint. Bodily integrity came up pretrial. It came up in our case in chief. It came up upon the motion for directed verdict at the close of our evidence, which is in the record, and it came up at the end before the charge conference.
Well, it came up, obviously, you're going through the various ways that can happen. At the pretrial, how did it come up? How clear was the issue at that time? I don't mean yes or no answer. What was the nature of it coming up pretrial?
Your Honor, I believe it was Judge Graves asked about the joint pretrial order that is submitted, of course, before you go to trial. And I didn't review it. I didn't include it as part of the record, and I don't have it. And I would be guessing if I told you what was contained in it. But the issue of the clear violations, meaning using the words bodily integrity, arose before, during, and after trial. We can supplement to the extent the court wants. We can get either portions of the record or writings to confirm that. But as Judge Freshner pointed out in his denial of the 12B6, he said this is a very well-pleaded complaint. We think Blackstock is liable under 1983.
What's he liable for? Of course, that's not the substantive source of liability. That's only a vehicle.
It is not, Your Honor.
So the question is, what provision of federal law, the Constitution or federal law, is the predicate here?
Section 1983 cases, and I can cite them to the court, at least read a few of them for the record, is clear that a public official acting under the color of state law is liable for sexually harassing a person. It can be a person pulled over. It could be an employee of theirs.
How?
Under 1983, acting under the color of state law, it is a...
I understand that.
Yes.
What is the underlying violation? It's a constitutional violation.
It's a violation. It's a due process violation.
Well, your pretrial order talks about equal protection claims.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So...
And so that would be the violation.
It's a...
Yeah.
Did you claim due process? Do you claim substantive due process? Is that what?
Yes, Your
Honor. Did you actually utter those words?
Yes, Your Honor. It is a violation of due process, my client's due process rights. And equal protection is the vehicle. I mean, that ultimately, that is the vehicle through which 1983, you can create a violation. And we demonstrated all of that.
And I may be misunderstanding this, but equal protection is a different claim than a due process claim, isn't it? When you say equal protection, I don't understand that to mean you are simultaneously saying due process.
It is not, Your Honor. They are totally different concepts. Equal protection is the claim at issue in this case. Due process, I misspoke.
There's no question about an equal protection claim. I think the question was that you mentioned a due process claim. And I heard your answer to be, I mentioned an equal protection claim.
I did. I mentioned an equal protection claim, not due process. I can't recall how the words came out, Your Honor, during trial. The claims for sexual harassment speak specifically, whether you're looking at Thompson v. Steele, Jefferson v. Isleta, Johnson v. Morrell, the Monell Supreme Court, Gross v. Grand Prairie, this court from 2002, involving a physical assault, all emanate from equal protection. It's all a violation.
I'm not sure that's right. I mean, maybe you're right, but
I've reviewed the cases. I certainly would stand to be corrected, Your Honor. But that is as I understand it, that is the violation. They have a right to be free from sexual harassment. They have a right to be free from being assaulted by a public official.
Well, the case law. We have a lot of cases dealing with school children, you know, and the coaches.
Yes.
Coaches are usually the wrongdoers, not always. And we have some other cases in certain areas, but I'm not sure we have a case exactly like this.
Well, Your Honor, all of the cases that I'm citing, at least most of these, involve either a police officer or another public official who fondled a female, for example, at a traffic stop. All of those types of cases, and there are numerous ones, Thompson's v. Belt, Hinshaw v. Doffer, the Gross v. Grand Prairie was an officer with the physical assault, groping or fondling of a female, they're all actionable violations of equal protection under 1983. All of those cases. Now, Title VII's a red herring. That dropped out of the case when we settled with the county, and we even put in the complaint that Blackstock is not being sued under Title VII individually.
Right.
So I believe that we're clear on that. So I wanted to clarify that issue for the court. And Judge Blackstock was found liable under sexual harassment under 1983, which stems from official oppression. That's what he was found guilty of criminally, and those are the exact same elements that the case law sets forth for liability under 1983. Official oppression by sexual harassment. That's number one. Secondly, violations of bodily integrity. And we allege in our complaint assault. We allege all of the facts that underlie it. We allege 1983. And there was no discovery done in this case, not an ounce, by Blackstock. There was no motion for more definite statement. There was no motion of any kind to attempt to get a clarification if Blackstock was confused in any way, shape, or form. But I want to move on, if I may, because I have limited time. I only have 11 minutes left. So I believe that the employer issue is a red herring at the end of the day. There's also a suggestion that bodily integrity is not a viable claim, and that's simply not true. Doe v. Taylor, Gonzalez v. Isleta, all Fifth Circuit, Southland v. Texas Board of Criminal Justice, and Jefferson v. Isleta, all Fifth Circuit, all finding bodily integrity violations under conduct nearly identical or very similar to this, fondling of breasts, fondling the buttocks of women, et cetera, and all found liability individually under 1983. I also cite to the Sixth, the Fourth, the Ninth, and the Eighth Circuits merely to show, although it's certainly not binding, but that other circuits rule almost unanimously the same way that the Fifth does on this exact same issue. So the concept that an individual gets off scot-free is simply not right. 1983 liability exists. There was an issue of the statute of limitations that was raised. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. The affirmative defense was never pled. In addition to, and I think it's waived, and in addition to that, we also have the concept that evidence is in the record, which I point to in the brief, between March of 08 and August, September of 08, when Blackstock left the bench, showing continued violations. And we argued continued violations. And
would
evidence.
Do you agree, though, that most of the evidence that you introduced would have been before, I don't remember if it was March 2010, is that when the pleading was filed?
Yes, Your Honor.
How many incidents occurred within 2 years of that?
Between March of 08 and August or September of 08, my reading of the record is that there was the fondling of the breasts at least once, if not twice, of Ms. Kalina. Ms. Strawn and Ms. Sermons suffered requests for hugs or requests for kisses. The majority of the conduct, Your Honor, occurred prior to March of 08. But there were, and of the more grave nature, other than the grabbing of the breasts or the request for the hugs, the majority was before March, but there were acts that occurred afterwards, including the continued requests for the hugs, the requests for the touches. Because the affirmative defense was not pled, I did not develop the record with respect to an exact calendar, but there clearly, and Judge Hoyt found evidence, that post-March of 08, there were sufficient acts to create liability within 2 years, even were it not waived.
And the judge was still on the bench until, what, August March of 08?
Until August or September of 08.
Right.
So there were at least 5 to 6 months of conduct occurred. And my clients testified until he left the bench, his conduct continued. Okay. And then they gave examples of that. But I would have developed the record a bit more specifically had there been a defense of statute of limitations. So I believe it's waived, but if it isn't, there's sufficient record evidence to support the claims. The only argument with respect to punitive damages not being awarded by Blackstock was that bodily integrity goes away, ergo you lose punitive, the right to punitive. There's no discussion that the amount was unconstitutional under BMW v. Gore, et cetera. Just bodily integrity goes away, so does punitive. But it ignores that there's a sexual harassment claim actionable per the cases I cite to the court and that I did with Judge Hoyt under 1983. And I still think bodily integrity remains as a claim in the case. But I need to address, for the purposes of our sole point of error, the BMW v. Gore analysis, because Judge Hoyt, after trial, and sua sponte, in issuing an amended JNOV order, says that the punitive damage award to him, $1 million apiece, appeared to be, based on his observation of the evidence of the witnesses, et cetera, to be excessive, and that the jurors might have been or were driven by prejudice. There is absolutely no evidence, though, in the record. And the district judge, with due respect to Judge Hoyt, is not to simply insert his own feeling of what the evidence showed. And the evidence in this case, if we look through specifically what BMW v. Gore says, what the Fifth Circuit says, you look to the reprehensibility of the conduct, you look to the ratios between the actual damages and punitives, and you look to comparable cases. And Gore and its progeny talk about reprehensibility perhaps being the single most important factor.
Well,
yes,
and I want to deal with this punitive damages issue because there are going to be provisions in most places that a judge can reduce an award, and the language may vary, but it's to the effect that if the verdict evinces some bias, passion, or prejudice on the part of the jury,
yes,
that a judge then would have the authority to reduce that award, and that's a recognition of the fact that the judge is in the courtroom, he's in that environment for the entirety of the trial, he sees what's going on, he has some observations about what the jury may or may not be responding to, what the lawyers are saying, and so ultimately his determination was that he thought the award evidenced some bias on the part of this jury and that bias had to do with the judge's status and
right.
position.
Correct.
You know, now my first reaction to that is it's perfectly appropriate to take into account that the judge was a public official, should be held to a higher standard, is in a position of trust. But this status and position, the judge seemed to be suggesting that they were inclined to be more punitive just because of Now, I don't know what he meant when he said status and position, but the whole public official component, I think, is appropriate. The status and position part, I'm not sure what he meant with all that.
Well, I think you're
right. But that's the reason he gave. Here's where I'm headed, though. Yeah. I don't know if there's enough for me to understand his reason. But the argument, there is an argument that if the judge determines that a remittiture is appropriate, then the offer has to be made to the plaintiff, either accept the remittiture or a new trial on the issue of damages. And apparently that didn't occur in this case. And so I understand that your complaint in the first instance is going to be he shouldn't have reduced the award at all.
Right.
And I don't know how to explain what he said. I think that cuts both ways. But talk to me about whether or not you should have been offered remittiture or new trial.
The law says that we are to be made that offer. The law says that. And the law says, and there are some cases, I'm not going to quote all of them at the moment. I'll find them in my my notes that have become disheveled, but there are cases that say that a judge's significant remittiture may be an abuse of discretion and that a new trial should have been offered in its stead. And we weren't offered that. Now, I don't want a new trial, and I would have.
You anticipated my question.
Yes. I don't.
Are you asking for that, and do you really want?
No, I don't want that. I don't want a new trial. This was, my client suffered enough, and if that's all I'm left with, I will take it, clearly. But I think in this case, the judge had an obligation to go through the Gore factors, BMW v. Gore, because clearly a person's position of trust and level in society goes to the reprehensibility. It is more reprehensible for a judge in his own chambers with women with which he has worked for years, one of whom he knew as a child. And to abuse that trust is far more reprehensible over a period of time than an isolated event, perhaps. Judge Hoyt cites but to one case from Eastern District of Texas where a police officer tussled with two 70-year-old men, one being bruised, the other, the court said, with a greater harm to his dignity. $100,000 to each man for punitive damages in that single isolated case. Here we have a judge clearly to be respected as peace officers, et cetera, and trusted. But with repeated offensive over years and years, not just of my clients, but of others. And I think it does not offend the conscience. It certainly does not offend the Constitution if you award a female $100,000 or $50,000, which is a sizable sum. $1 million is not so offensive. This court has upheld 10-to-1 ratios, and I have a litany of cases that the court has available to itself. Watson v. Johnson Mobile Homes is one, Fifth Circuit 02, 4,000 actual damages, 150,000 punitive. 4,000 is not de minimis or nominal. It's a lot of money, too. But the jury found that what the judge did was wrong, and I think that Judge Hoyt actually made a mistake by saying that the position caused the bias. It should have. There are plenty of cases that say that the position can be a factor in reprehensibility. The ratio of 10-to-1 for one of the plaintiffs and 20-to-1 for the others, although it's not single digit, it doesn't shock the conscience. In this kind of case, it doesn't shock the conscience. I'm asking this court to vacate, to undo what Judge Hoyt did in remitting the punitives and to set it back where it was. And if this court determines, as it has in other cases, that 20-to-1 is too high, I've suggested, a lower than 10-to-1 or 20-to-1, but higher than a 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 ratio, a 5-to-7-to-1. But the ratio in and of itself, this court has said, is not, there's no precise mathematic formula. Gore doesn't mandate that. This court's supposed to look at each case and to say, does this fit within the confines of the particulars? And the judge's conduct was not poor judgment. He assaulted women. The fact that he pled to criminal misconduct, the fact that he resigned from the bench, is indicia of the gravity and the severity of what occurred. And so I think that this court should reverse and the judge's reduction of the punitive award and to render for what the jury did. There simply isn't enough from what Judge Hoyt tells us to determine what he did. And I think the court has an obligation to do that. And if it doesn't, then I think this court gets to look at the record as a whole, fresh, de novo and say, we think what the jury did was right, was okay by us. That's where I come from. I think that all of the case law that I have either cited in the record or that we have cited in our brief supports the claims. To the extent that the court wants additional briefing on where this bodily integrity concept first was mentioned by name, even though I don't think that's required, but to the extent the court asks for that or would be helpful, I would ask for maybe 14 days to submit that, or 7 days even, to submit that to the court. To the extent it's not, then we will leave the record as it stands. I'm going to give back my last 10 seconds.
Good for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Griffin.
On page 41 of our brief, we set out the actions that Kalana complained about. She said on 9/19/2007, her breast was touched. On 10/15/2007, she said her buttocks was touched. On 8/9/2007, she said offending remarks were made to her. And that's the same information that showed up in her EEOC charge that Mr. Blackstock wasn't named as a party. On sermons, she complained of receiving one email on 1/8/2008 and that her buttocks was strummed. And those are her words, strummed in the elevator on 3/14/2008. And Strong complained that she was touched on 12/2005 on her buttocks, and complained that her breast was touched on 3/9/2007. And we admit in our brief that there was only one incident that occurred within a two-year statute of limitation period if you apply a two-year statute.
Well, didn't she have a hostile work environment claim?
Most of them admitted that once they said to Mr. Blackstock outside of the two-year period, they had no other contact with him, but they said that they were fearful and then going, but he never did anything else.
That's a hostile work environment claim, isn't it?
That's a hostile work environment claim. It's still subject to limitations, and there wasn't an allegation of continuing violation until, well, excuse me, it was. It was alleged in the pleadings.
Well, I think what at least one of the plaintiffs said is I tried to avoid him after he touched my buttocks in the elevator, so you can certainly understand her seeking to avoid him. But that doesn't mean the environment improved, does it?
But I don't think it means the environment improved, but then it vitiates the whole concept of discrete acts, that the statute has to run at some point in time. And with regards to that, if the court will note, some incidents took place back in 2005, 5 years before. Some incidents took place back 3 years before. And there was only a couple of incidents from sermons where she had one incident in 2008.
All right. And I don't want to draw you away from that subject prematurely. You got 2 minutes left. What evidence is there in the record to support the judge's determination that the finding on punitive damage is evidence of some bias, passion, or prejudice on the part of the jury? And he summed it up by saying it related to the judge's, I think he said, position and status. What evidence is there to support that finding by the jury?
I think the verdict itself is passed the pale, and I think the Supreme Court
it's
in the
just too high. So they must have been.
The Supreme Court, when they address punitive damages, one of the things the court dealt with in the BMW case was, can't on the face of the verdict itself it be insulting, you know, and the verdict itself is insulting based on, and the reason I started with those facts is to say what's in this record factually. In addition, we wrote in our brief.
You don't want to talk about what's insulting. Given the conduct that we have in this case, you're telling me a verdict is insulting?
The punitive award is insulting in context of the established law in our circuit.
All right.
I think that's what I'm saying.
All right.
You will not hear me stand before this court and say, you know, I think we should have open season on attacking females. That's not my position. And I apologize to the court if it's interpreted that way. But I also, in our reply brief, said that one of the white elephant that was existed in this room is that this case was tried in Judge Kent's court in the Southern District, where there was tons of publicity about what had occurred. And even the jurors, when we went through the jury selection process, some of that got mentioned. So that white elephant in the room is there may have been bias that existed in terms of where the case was tried in proximity to what had occurred in the Galveston Division for the Southern District.
Now, did you object on the basis that you don't want to be this case tried in Galveston?
No, I did not, Your Honor. I've
Well, wouldn't that be the way to solve that problem?
I understand that, Your Honor.
And Judge Hoyt certainly has a courtroom at 515 Rusk.
He did. My client wanted a trial, if I remember correctly, in, of the citizens of Brazoria County and folks in that jurisdiction, so we did not object. I went back and checked, since I have a very short time. There's no mention of the words due process in the plaintiff's complaint.
Well, no, he's now, what he says is the constitutional claim he's asserting is equal protection.
There's no mention of equal protection in his complaint. And in the opening statement that shows up in volume 12, there's no mention of equal protection, and his opening statement runs from page 22 to page 29. There's no reference whatsoever to those words. And then the last thing, Your Honor, and I'll sit down, and I thank the court for the opportunity of appearing before you, is with regards to the issue of damages, remittiture, by the court not following the proper procedure, offering remittiture or new trial, it deprives the defendant of that portion of the law. And I thank the court, and it's been my honor to appear before you.
Thank you.